This week on Your Western Context, we look into the questionable pasts of Alberta NDP candidates. BC gas prices jumped to record amounts after a carbon tax increase, and the Trudeau government aggressively pursued the Cotter payout leak. Also, Philpott and Jody Wilson-Raybould are booted from the Liberals. This is Western Context, episode 113, recorded Saturday, April 6th, 2019. The Tuesday Night Massacre. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again for another episode of Western Context. We're back this week. We're well into spring, and this Alberta election campaign is trucking along, but that, of course, doesn't mean that we don't have news from the rest of Canada to talk about.
Yeah, that's right. As the weather gets warmer, definitely the media has been talking about a lot of different stories, and a few have flown rather under the radar in the last week or so, and I think that's what we're going to be highlighting for you today.
Indeed, and you know, that's one of the things that made this podcast in the very beginning, and is very much classic Western Context, talking about the stories that the media don't talk about. And if you guys want to join us on that road, just head over to westerncontext.ca. You can get full show notes there. You can follow along, see all the supplementary URLs and sources that we use to put these stories together. And thank you for joining us on our efforts to put all the information and context necessary out there to you guys to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So we're starting in Alberta this week, and you know, we're heading into the fourth week of the election campaign, and the media has been all but keen to talk about the so-called bozo eruptions in the United Conservative Party. And in particular this week, they were talking about Mark Smith, who was elected in 2015 for the Wild Rose Party, representing Drayton Valley and Devon. He is now running for re-election under the UCP, and an audio recording surfaced of him giving a sermon back in 2013, questioning why TV shows would be ultimately putting out there for their viewers as showing homosexual love as good love, as he mentioned. Now, also UCP candidate Roger Reed was also highlighted, and this was in a 2003 newsletter that he wrote, yes, all the way back in 2003, 16 years ago, where he wrote a book review for a book entitled The Homosexual Agenda. In his review, he wrote, "The homosexual agenda has its primary aim to trump the rights of all other groups, especially those with the people of faith." Now, UCP leader Jason Kenney has been quick to condemn these views, and did so many times this week in radio interviews, online, and even at the leaders' debate this week. And both candidates as well have also issued apology statements saying that their views have evolved since they penned these sermons, or the letter in the case of Roger Reed. Now, the news of the week should have ultimately been the stark comparison between the NDP's 52-page platform and the UCP's 118-page platform that's filled with figures, links, and citations. This week also saw the leaders' debate on Thursday, where Liberal leader David Kahn told us about his fiscal plan to bring in a harmonized sales tax of 8% numerous times, and he also mentioned that he was the only lawyer on the stage, and that making constitutional challenges towards the government of Canada isn't something that should be taken lightly. That seemed to be the main reason that he was there. UCP leader Jason Kenney and NDP leader Rachel Notley both attacked each other back and forth. Well, Jason Kenney offered a policy and a vision forward, while Rachel Notley ultimately kept telling the audience what Jason Kenney would do if he was elected premier. Meanwhile, Alberta Party leader Stephen Mandel was also there, and he provided comic relief when David Kahn insisted that he wanted to provide private health care, so much so as going to insinuate that David Kahn was smoking something that he shouldn't have been, even though we all know that in this day and age here in Canada, marijuana is legal. So we have to ask ourselves, how does the media wind up covering these stories consistently, but none of the NDP candidates passed associations? And, you know, there's a rather interesting food chain of news on this, the way these stories, all of the stories regarding the United Conservative Party members, has how that's evolved through the entire campaign. Now, you have news sources such as Press Progress, which posted the majority of these letters or evidence pieces, as they call them, on UCP candidates. And it's worth noting that Press Progress was launched by the Broadbent Institute, which is an NDP think tank, of course, started by former federal NDP leader Ed Broadbent. Following this, the stories gained traction on social media, and then the big news companies such as CBC and Global ultimately picked them up, making them the talking points for the week. But on the other hand, we have the NDP running pretty much unchecked in that same area this week. At the debate, both Jason Kenney and Stephen Mandel brought up a story from last November suggesting that there were two NDP caucus members that were under investigation for sexual misconduct, but the decision was also made to keep their names private in order to protect the victim. Both Jason Kenney and Stephen Mandel asked Rachel Notley about this, but she deflected both times. There is also a Calgary Herald article that was surfaced this week from 1999 alleging that Joe Cece, the finance minister and candidate for Calgary Buffalo, had sexually assaulted a minor numerous times while volunteering at a juvenile detention center in the 1970s. We also have the case of the many NDP candidates that have questionable backgrounds as well, including Anne McGrath, who is running for the NDP in Calgary Varsity. Now, Anne McGrath is a name you might have heard of before, as she has done some advising work for Rachel Notley while she was premier. She, in 1984, Anne McGrath, ran for the Communist Party of Canada and ultimately argued that Canada needed to bring under public ownership the United States multinational branch plants, banks, natural resource companies, as well as the auto and steel industries. And, you know, we, at this point in time, should take a look at communist ideology, in particular in Stalin's USSR and Mao's China. It's these two regimes, these two brutal communist regimes, have been responsible for over 80 million deaths of people that didn't want to go along with that ideology. And we can say that Anne McGrath was a student at the time in 1984 at the University of Alberta, ran for the Communist Party while the USSR was still indeed a thing. And it seems as though no one has ventured out to ask Anne McGrath about why she made that decision to run for the Communist Party, or if she still holds those views as she is running potentially to be a member of the legislature. Now, there's also Edmonton Ellerslie candidate Rod Loyola, who has praised former Venezuela dictator Hugo Chavez and ultimately mourned his death when Hugo Chavez passed away. Now, anybody can look at the news and see what's happening in Venezuela, and that's currently a basket case of a country due to the leadership of Hugo Chavez. We also have Peter Muller running in Cyprus Medicine Hat, who in the past has called Canadian idiots and equated former Prime Minister Stephen Harper with Adolf Hitler. There's also Deborah Drever in Calgary Bow, who gave the finger to the Canadian flag and was reprimanded from caucus in 2015 after making light of sexual assault. Then there's also Craig Coulihan running in Calgary Klein, who enjoyed about employing eugenics on one of his Twitter followers who is criticizing him. And Rachel Notley herself has been shown in the past to be wearing a Che Guevara watch. Che Guevara played a huge role in the Cuban Revolution and was ultimately a minister in Fidel Castro's government. Now, the only place to actually shine a light on some of these NDP candidates was an opinion piece in the Calgary Herald by former Wild Rose Party leader and floor crosser Danielle Smith. Her article details Anne McGrath, Rod Loyola, and Rachel Notley, but also talks about how the unions are active in this race, donating via political action committees. We know that in 2015, union and corporate donations were banned, but that doesn't do anything to stop political action committees from working in an election. So far, Project Alberta, funded by Unifor, has contributed $135,000 in campaign money. $270,000 has been spent by the Alberta Teachers Association, $60,000 by the Alberta Federation of Labor, and the Firefighters of Alberta Association has spent just over $61,000 in related lobbying. So while we see that corporate and union donations are supposed to be limited to $30,000, PACs can ultimately get around this and campaign for the NDP. Now, if the NDP, combined with their PACs and the media wing at Press Progress, can look into past UCP candidates, and then the media ultimately runs with these stories to stoke the emotions of their viewers and readers to ultimately garner more views and clicks, the same should happen for the NDP. But as we've seen, that hasn't been happening this week, except for this one piece here in the Calgary Herald. The media here this week is only providing a platform to highlight the blemishes of only one party. Now, this is the problem with this race, and if not for the economy being a genuine issue for the majority of Albertans, the media would be largely successful in their efforts to sway the election.
Yeah, exactly. There's been so many different many different MLAs here that have had questionable pasts, and the fact that only one party seems to be in the media for things that happened in the past, that party being the UCP, of course, it begs the question as to why the media isn't trying to go on to both sides of the argument and look at both of the major parties in Alberta to see what exactly the candidates are actually looking at. If you see this federally, we've seen this a lot where both Liberal and Conservative, as well as NDP candidates federally, have been investigated, and there's been lots of talk in elections past about different candidates who have done questionable things. But it's weird how in Alberta, it just seems to be the UCP that's being looked at by the media. You'd think that if we have a free and open media where there would be supposedly no bias, there would be multiple different parties looked at here, but it doesn't seem to be the case this week.
Yeah, and you know, I think I'm not sure which one is the biggest one on the NDP side, whether it's Anne McGrath formerly running for the Communist Party or the guy from Calgary talking about employing eugenics on one of his followers, and you know, if that guy knew anything about the history of Alberta, they would know that the previous social credit government did go into doing that, and that is indeed one of the dark spots in Alberta history. But you know, lo and behold, nothing happened on that. And you know, we typically hear don't link to partisan sources when citing from news releases and whatnot. You know, if there's a news release by the UCP or the NDP, we'll see what the journalists are saying and go from there rather than copy direct from the party's website. But in this case, this week, the United Conservatives did put out an interesting website, which is linked in our supplemental URLs, where they go into the history of many of these candidates that we mentioned here, many more than we actually mentioned in this segment. And you can have a look here and see the candidates' history, both based on what they did prior to being elected, as well as what some of the incumbents did as well. And it's really quite shocking looking at this page, seeing what's on here. There's also some that are downright hilarious as well, but I'll leave that as an exercise for the listeners to find as well. But all of that and more can be found in the supplementary notes at westerncontext.ca.
All right. I think that we'll be seeing a lot more out of the Alberta election campaign as it draws close to a close in the next week and a half or so. And we're going to head on to BC now, where, of course, another week goes by in BC. And as we start to get close to summer, there are two things that always hold true, and that's warmer weather and higher gas prices. Now, on Thursday this past week, gas prices in BC went up by an astounding 12-cent increase on average, following a rise in the provincial carbon tax from $30 per ton to $40 per ton, which is actually double the $20 per ton that was the amount forced upon the provinces of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, and New Brunswick by the federal government on April 1st. Now, those four provinces were the last holdouts in Canada without a provincial carbon tax set. And if you actually look at the leadership of those four provinces, it's not a coincidence that all four of them are led by Conservative governments. Now, the carbon tax increase was meant to raise prices by 1.2 cents, but instead we got a jump that was 12 times that. Metro Vancouver actually saw the highest gas price ever in their recorded history, hitting an astounding 1.64 $6 per liter. Now, with another increase expected this year on the dedicated TransLink tax from 17 cents to 18.5 cents per liter, Vancouver drivers should expect the gas taxes levied by the province to go up and not down. It's also why gas tends to be cheaper once you leave Metro Vancouver and fill up in Abbotsford. It should be noted also that Victoria has a dedicated transit tax of 5.5 cents. Now, provincial taxes make up 34 cents of every liter of gas purchased in Metro Vancouver. Federal taxes, including GST, bump up the total tax to 52 cents, which is almost one-third of the cost of a tank, with prices around 160 cents per liter. Now, of that 52 cents of fuel tax, 17 is for TransLink, 10 cents is for federal taxes, 8.8 cents is for the carbon tax, 7.6 cents is GST on top of the federal tax, and 1.8 cents is for provincial taxes, and 6.8 cents is for the BC Transportation Financing Authority, that is the Crown Corporation that owns all provincial highways and has a mandate to plan, acquire, construct, hold, improve, or operate transportation infrastructure throughout BC. Now, BC Premier John Horgan says that the BC government will consider some relief for those who can't afford record high gas prices. Horgan says his government will monitor prices at the pumps over the summer, but he also suggested that provincial taxes aren't the only factor affecting prices. He says he can't explain a 12 cent a liter increase, and perhaps that the industry should invest more in refineries and the federal government should invest more in supply. And I think at this point you have to ask yourself the question, more refineries and more supply, much like the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion and refinery in Burnaby that the Horgan government has been against and has been spending BC taxpayer money to fight tooth and nail in the courts, like that refinery and supply. This has been, I think, the largest dose of hypocrisy dealt by John Horgan since he took office as premier 2 years ago. To suggest that the reason gas prices are going up is because the federal government isn't investing in pipelines or that the oil companies aren't investing in refineries is quite astounding. Now, just yesterday, Horgan clarified his remarks, and while he said his government would look at relief from record high gas prices, it's clear that it's just an empty promise that he doesn't want to keep. One day after hinting that the provincial government could provide relief to drivers, Premier John Horgan actually ruled out reducing gas taxes to do just that. Despite Metro Vancouver having the highest pump prices in Canada, almost a third of which are taxes, Horgan said that he is hopeful prices will come down without government intervention as supply pressures ease. Now, he said, quote, "I want to be clear again, reducing the 1 cent a liter increase in the carbon tax we introduced on April 1st does not answer the question about high prices for consumers. The high prices for consumers are a direct result of the lack of connection between the commodity price for a barrel of oil and the retail price," which, as we can see, is just simply not true. Now, BC Liberal MLA Jazz Johal took issue with the carbon tax, saying that when his government created it, the intention was for it to be revenue neutral. He accused the NDP of turning it into just another tax, although some economists have pointed out that it began to lose some of its revenue neutrality as early as 2014, before neutrality was abandoned altogether by the NDP after the last election. Now, Johal said that the increased carbon tax is becoming a drag on the economy, as it has a trickle-down effect on the price of basic goods and services, including groceries and clothing. And he also mentioned that BC already leads Canada and much of the world with its carbon tax. In the end, the taxes upon taxes on BC fuel are just going to take money out of BC wallets and directly give that money to the government for spending at their discretion, which of course will impact low-income earners more disproportionately. It's just another way that BC is becoming more increasingly unaffordable.
You know, I have a question, and I think many of our listeners perhaps have a question about this story. You know, when John Horgan made the talk about the federal government investing in supply, was this on April Fool's Day?
It was actually not on April Fool's Day. You would think that this would be an April Fool's Day joke, but he was actually being serious about this, and it was interesting because this came about just on Thursday, which would have been the 4th, which would have been quite some number of days after April 1st. So you would think that this does sound like a joke, but it was a real news story, and it was interesting because his remarks weren't actually covered all that much in the media.
And they're not grounded in reality either. You know, he would see if it was grounded in reality, they'd see that the rest of the country, in particular Alberta, Saskatchewan, and the Trudeau government by token efforts has been trying to build that pipeline. But it's his government that is standing in the way. And it's just absolutely absurd that no one in the media seemed to question him on this. And this story comes out citing John Horgan saying that. And, you know, we're left here pointing out that, yeah, that's actually a good dose of hypocrisy in that. And, you know, at the end of the day, the BC people are paying when they fill up their tanks with gas for more for the carbon tax and whatnot and many other things when it comes to the carbon tax, being the carbon tax is moving away from revenue neutral. It just speaks a lot to the NDP government in Victoria, I think. Story.
I think so too, and especially when you consider that the wholesale price of oil, land, and gas in places like Montreal or Toronto or Halifax or even Calgary are hovering around, you know, 75 to 85 cents, whereas in Vancouver it's all the way up to 105 to 110 cents per liter. So this is it's quite something that Horgan was protesting against Trans Mountain Pipeline. It's one of the defining issues of his premiership. And then to suggest that the federal government isn't doing enough to invest in pipelines is quite absurd. And I think this is probably one of the funniest things that I've read out of John Horgan. I think that's defining BC this week.
Indeed. We do also have some things that are not funny coming up because they're indeed very, very serious and deal with many facets of the government that should worry everyone federally. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to mention our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support where you can support the podcast. So for $2 a month, at the price of a cup of coffee, you help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, or the price of a sandwich, you can continue to do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And when we reach $25 a month in contribution, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And finally, at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarter. Topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution via PayPal. You can do that and find more information about this at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so our Canada story goes back to the Omar Khadr settlement, which we recently talked about a few weeks back in terms of him buying a strip mall in Edmonton for around $3 million. But it turns out that the National Post obtained an internal report detailing a federal investigation going on that spanned six departments and agencies to hunt for who ultimately leaked the information about the $10.5 million payout to the Globe and Mail back in July of 2017. Now, the Privy Council office, the same Privy Council's office that is embroiled in the SNC-Lavalin scandal, is refusing to say if it referred this investigation probe to the RCMP. And remember this, because this is going to be a big deal going forward on this. Now, the PCO has done this before with the leak investigation into Vice Admiral Mark Norman, and that's scheduled to go to trial this fall. Mark Norman is alleged to have released sensitive government information regarding the procurement of naval supply ships, which ultimately constitutes a breach of trust and is prosecutable. Now, the report on the Omar Khadr payout says that the payment was delayed by a day due to a coding error that caused it to be rejected by the Bank of Canada. The payment then went through an account held by an unknown third party, and there's potentially two reasons for this. The first is that the government wanted to be able to release the press release on this matter later in July 17 when they could control it, or they wanted the money to not be trackable by the families in the United States, which are currently suing Omar Khadr. Now, news of this settlement wasn't supposed to go out, but the Globe and Mail reported on it that Friday afternoon back in July of 2017 and made this information known to Canadians. The federal government ultimately sought to hide the fact that they are going to pay $10.5 million to Omar Khadr. What's more, as long as 2 months later, in September 2017, the Privy Council office was still searching for who leaked this to the media. According to the report, government officials ratified the settlement with Khadr on June 22, 2017. The next week, staff from the Departments of Global Affairs, Justice, Public Safety, and the Privy Council, as well as the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, began putting together a communication strategy for the settlement. And now let's just unpack this here. That's Global Affairs, or previously known as Foreign Affairs, the Justice Department, which Jody Wilson-Raybould would have been head of at the time, Public Safety, which is Ralph Goodale, the Privy Council, as well as CSIS, which is effectively like our CIA, began putting together a communication strategy on how to communicate the fact that the federal government paid $10.5 million to Omar Khadr. Now, when asked this week by the National Post, the Privy Council office didn't answer any questions if the leaker was ever found. They also asked the RCMP if this answer was referred to them. The answer was no. Now, you're probably wondering, why is this a big deal? This is a big deal because Mark Norman is potentially going to be the first person in Canada to be criminally prosecuted for a violation of cabinet confidence. And taking this up to one higher level, cabinet confidence is precisely what in the past and is still holding both Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott from being able to testify and expose everything that happened in regards to SNC-Lavalin. Now, on one hand here with this story, you have the Privy Council's office and the Prime Minister trying to hide a payout to a known terrorist. Secondly, this government is downright hostile and perhaps bordering on paranoid in terms of hunting down leaks within its own government department. Now, when you combine this with the SNC-Lavalin case, this creates a picture of government that is bent on control and should ultimately worry all Canadians.
Yeah, this is true. Just the fact that all of those different departments of the government were working together to try and figure out a communication strategy for the settlement that was given to Omar Khadr just goes to show that they knew that this wasn't going to go down well with the public and that they wanted to find a way so that they could try and either soften the blow, perhaps by releasing the news on a Friday, or, you know, by trying to, control the mission so that it wouldn't be found out by the media and that it wouldn't be found out by Canadians exactly how much they were paying Omar Khadr. And I think that goes to show the priorities that this government had when it came to dealing with Omar Khadr, and that Trudeau was once famously told a veteran at a town hall that veterans are asking for more than they were willing to give. But it was pretty clear that they were willing to give quite a bit to Omar Khadr and to try and hide the fact that they were doing so.
Yeah. When you look at this, the very fact that we now know that this payout didn't go directly to Khadr, it went through a third party. You don't put something through a third party unless you're trying to hide something. It's as simple as that. And, you know, whether or not this will come back to bite the government, I don't know. And, you know, there's a good chance we could have heard more about this week, but there's that one story that's been going on since February 7th that just keeps giving and giving and giving, and that's SNC-Lavalin. And, you know, linking what we have seen happen with SNC-Lavalin and now this Omar Khadr case and Mark Norman, it paints a picture of a prime minister's office and an executive branch of government, the cabinet, that is focused on loyalty, blind loyalty, and doing whatever they can to stay in power and make sure that the narrative that they want gets out there And, you know, if it weren't for these leaks, there's a good chance that we, you know, would have found out in a different way about the Cotter payout. And the very fact that this government wanted to hide a payout to a terrorist from Canadians should speak volumes. And I think we can leave it at that.
That's true. And I think that leads us actually quite nicely into our last segment, which is going to be our firing line, which we normally do as a story that was either not covered by the media or wasn't covered fairly, or is just something that's so supremely absurd as that we have to cover it. And I think in this case, it was something that is more increasingly being covered fairly by the media, but not all of the details are being put to light on this issue. And I think when we start talking about it, that will become very clear. I think I should mention to start off with, this past Tuesday, Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott, for those who have been either living under a rock or haven't been connected to any news sources, they were, of course, the former cabinet ministers who resigned Trudeau's cabinet in the wake of the SNC scandal that's being known as LavScam. And, of course, this is still ongoing. On Tuesday, they were kicked out of the Liberal caucus, and they now sit as independent MPs. Now, what's interesting to note about this is that on Tuesday evening at 5:45 p.m., there was supposed to be a previously unscheduled meeting of the full Liberal caucus that were going to decide whether Wilson-Raybould and Philpott could actually still remain as Liberal MPs. However, Jody Wilson-Raybould made a tweet at 5:44 p.m., which is, as you note, 1 minute earlier than the caucus meeting start. That said, quote, "I have just been informed by the Prime Minister of Canada that I'm removed from the Liberal caucus and as the confirmed Vancouver Granville candidate for the Liberal Party of Canada in the 2019 federal election. What I can say is that I hold my head high and that I can look myself in the mirror, knowing that I did what I was required to do and what needed to be done based on principles and values that must always transcend party." Jane Philpott also issued a statement that was scathing towards her critics as well as Trudeau. She said, quote, "Tonight I was expelled by the caucus of the Liberal Party of Canada. Sadly, the decision was made without me being provided any opportunity to speak to National Caucus. This was profoundly disheartening for me, my staff, and my family, and I know people in Markham Stouffville will also be disappointed. I was accused publicly by people in caucus of not being loyal, of trying to bring down the Prime Minister, of being politically motivated, and of being motivated by my friendship with Jody Wilson-Raybould. These accusations were coupled with public suggestions that I should be forced out of caucus. These attacks were based on inaccuracies and falsehoods. I did not initiate the crisis now facing the party or the Prime Minister, nor did Jody Wilson-Raybould." Now, in the wake of the dismissal, the CBC, Toronto Star, and other left-leaning, or otherwise known as liberal-friendly outlets, were quick to point out that this was a caucus decision. However, the timings clearly point out that it was not a caucus decision, and just like the scandal itself, it all came down to Trudeau's decision. Last week, we discussed Wilson-Raybould's recorded testimony to the Justice Committee, in which she submitted a taped phone call between herself and Michael Wernick, the now-resigned former clerk of the Privy Council, which is Canada's most senior public servant. Now, in that testimony, it became clear that Trudeau had directly ordered the political interference in the criminal proceedings of SNC-Lavalin in order to get a deferred prosecution agreement that would let SNC off the hook. Now, listening to Trudeau, it's clear that the most worrying thing of this whole situation is what Trudeau is concerned about. Now, for once, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau got publicly angry about LavScam. He wasn't angry, however, about the disregard for the rule of law. He wasn't angry about the fact that his former top bureaucrat, Wernick, and former top advisor, Gerald Butts, persistently pushed to have criminal proceedings against SNC-Lavalin tossed in favor of a separate agreement, and he also wasn't angry that his failure to address the original sin of this whole saga has brought us up point where on Tuesday evening Trudeau made the decision to boot Wilson-Raybould and Philpott from the Liberal caucus to now sit as independents. No, what he was actually angry about was that Wilson-Raybould recorded that 17-minute phone call with Wernick that proves that the constant pressure actually did happen. Trudeau said more dramatically than usual during a public address that, quote, if a politician secretly records a conversation with anyone, it's wrong. When that politician is a cabinet minister secretly recording a public servant, it's wrong. And when that cabinet minister is the Attorney General of Canada secretly recording the clerk of the Privy Council, it's unconscionable. Now, it's clear that public opinion is turning on Trudeau, as more and more believe the two former female cabinet ministers over the prime minister, who the Toronto Sun labeled as a fake feminist in their headline on the issue, it's pretty clear that Trudeau is out of touch with what Canadians actually want, which is an apology, an admission of guilt, and quite possibly his resignation. Now, an apology is all that Wilson Raybould said that she wanted. Sources said that after Wilson Raybould was shuffled out of her role as Justice Minister in January, that she told the Prime Minister that she would stay in Cabinet under certain conditions. These included, apparently, firing Trudeau's top advisor Gerald Butts, Privy Council Clerk Michael Wernick, and Senior Legal Advisor Matthew Bouchard. Now, all three were named in her testimony as involved in the sustained and inappropriate pressure that she says she faced on the SNC-Lavalin file. Now, none of that actually happened, although Butts subsequently resigned and Wernick has announced his upcoming retirement. Both have maintained that they did not act inappropriately and have offered contradicting evidence and testimony to the events as she described. Bouchard remains employed by the Prime Minister's office. Now, Wilson Raybould apparently also wanted Trudeau to apologize either publicly or before cabinet. Finally, she apparently also wanted assurances that her replacement as Justice Minister and Attorney General David Lametti would be directed to not authorize a deferred prosecution agreement for SNC-Lavalin, which is something that she publicly denies. Now, in a statement Thursday evening, Wilson Raybould condemned the leaked information and said that she would never interfere with the Attorney General's role. She said, quote, I would not respond to leak information from anonymous sources other than to note the continual and inappropriate use of this tactic, but I can say that I've never and would never seek to interfere with the exercise of prosecutorial discretion by the Attorney General of Canada. Now, Philpott echoed this denial, saying, quote, I think people need to be extremely careful. I, of course, am disturbed as to who these sources would be and what their motivations would be for sharing this information. And particularly, she questioned the allegation that Wilson Raybould wanted to make sure that Lametti would not be directed to pursue a DPA. Now, she said, that's a preposterous allegation. Why would the former Attorney General spend months ensuring that there was no political interference in this very important criminal case and then turn around and do the opposite? So after all this, I think it's pretty clear what the sources of the leaks are, and that it's obviously directly from Trudeau's PMO, in an attempt to discredit Wilson Raybould as well as Philpott. It's a last-ditch attempt for Trudeau to attempt some semblance of credibility, but opinion polls have consistently registered a drop in Liberal support, but more importantly, Trudeau's support personally. As Philpott said, there's no way that this could have been motivated by any perceived advantage. She said, quote, this also isn't about any political advantage or strategy. It's frankly absurd to suggest that I would leave one of the most senior portfolios in government for personal advancement or merely out of friendship with Jody Wilson Raybould. So it's pretty clear from all this that even after 2 months, this story isn't over yet. An interview between Vancouver Province's Mike Smith and Wilson Raybould is set to be released in the Sunday edition. Also, Andrew Scheer has scheduled a press release to, quote, present new documents relating to the SNC-Lavalin corruption scandal. So as we've reached 2 months of the scandal, it's clear it's not going anyway anytime soon. One has to wonder if the public will remember this spring's corruption when they go to the polls later this October to select their next government of Canada.
You know, if they don't remember this when they go to the polls this fall, that is the fault of the media, because this is something that, now that it's been proven true, if this was referred to the RCMP and wasn't protected by cabinet confidence and all the other tools that they have to protect themselves in the cabinet and the PMO, this would, if this was happening between any two people, any two corporations, this would be obstruction of justice, plain and simple. That's what it would be. And, you know, there were also people online calling this the Tuesday Night Massacre, of course, once again, hearkening back to Richard Nixon and him firing his attorney general to try and silence the story. Trudeau did the exact same thing here this Tuesday, booted them out of the caucus, which is the step that I think we said when this was first developing about a month ago, that this is the step that would make this stick in the media and this wouldn't help going forward. And, you know, another sick thing that came of this is that all of the Liberal caucus members, and they selectively allowed this part of the caucus meeting to be released to the media. All of the Liberal caucus members, after Trudeau gave the speech on the removal of Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott, were seen giving Justin Trudeau a standing ovation. So for anybody who voted for Liberal in the last election, or anybody who has a Liberal MP and is upset by this scandal, that's what your MP did. So remember that going forward.
Yeah, exactly. And this is going to have a huge impact on what's going to happen in the next election. And if it doesn't, then clearly that's up to the media for not letting us know about all these scandals. And we have to remember, this isn't the first scandal that Trudeau has been in. There's, of course, the scandal with the India trip, where a convicted attempted murderer was brought along, and all the other scandals that have happened throughout the years that Trudeau has tried to cover up and has still failed to do so. And, you know, it just comes down to a government that's trying to stay in power and is trying to do whatever they can to try and keep public opinion on their side. They've tried throwing money at the issue. They've tried lining up op-eds that would be favorable to them. They've tried even directly giving money to the media to be able to get them, keep them going, and which pretty much destroys any credible impartiality that the media would have on this issue. And I think all of these things together, put together, it just shows a very clear picture on what Justin Trudeau and the Liberals want to have happen.
Yeah, and you know, it paints a picture, tying this as well into the Omar Khadr story, of a government, and in particular the cabinet and the prime minister, who will stop at nothing to do what they want to do. And one of the very early critiques, and this persisted throughout the entire 10 years or so of the Harper government, was that the PMO and the government was run like a dictatorship. Well, here we have actual people being kicked out of caucus in a similar vein to what they were saying happened with Harper, but this is in regards to something that boils down at the very core of it to obstruction of justice. And that's an angle that was missed in the media as well on this. And, you know, I just have to once again point out that the entire Liberal caucus that was there in that caucus meeting gave Trudeau a standing ovation. So that's all that needs to be said. That's the image that the government chose to release, and that should speak volumes.
That's for sure. I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week this week, which is leak. Now, that is defined as an intentional disclosure of secret information or the act of making it known. And I think in this case, we see two different leaks, one of which was, of course, the Omar Khadr payout to the media. And that was the leak that Trudeau was desperately trying to cover up. And we also saw, of course, the leak about SNC-Lavalin. In the first place, there was the leak that was first published in the Globe and Mail way back on February 7th. There was also the leak about supposedly Jody Wilson-Raybould's motivations and wanting to stay in cabinet. And it's pretty clear that leaks that the government is trying to plug, and it's also clear that there's also leaks that the government itself is trying to push out to try and garner support. So I think that is why leak is our word of the week this week.
And it's a real messy week, leaks included. So you want to recap on all this, you can find the show notes, including the supplementary URLs, including the list of NDP candidates and their histories and everything used to build the firing line, the Omar Khadr story, all that and more at westerncontext.ca in our full show notes. You can also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Google Play Podcasts or pretty much anywhere you can subscribe to podcasts at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the stories of the week, some of their supplementals, and of course, for the Alberta election, updates to our poll tracker, which currently features one green and one yellow poll heading into the final week of the race. So that can be found as well at westerncontext.ca/polls. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all of the stories that the mainstream media talks about and some that they don't talk about to make sure that you have all the context needed to put yourself on the right side of the news. With that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.